During the 30s, there was a terrific unemployment situation where workers could not get jobs. And demonstrations were organized against the employers to hire workers and to create more jobs for the people. And while marching, we sang songs and we also called out slogans. Give the bankers home relief. We want jobs.
How do you spell relief? The UCs and the WA organized the unemployed. Part two in a series of programs exploring the activities and achievements of militant women in the Great Depression.
When the crisis came along in 1930, I was so enraged. I was so angry when I saw that children didn't have enough to eat, that I just didn't know any fear or anything. I just went in fighting like anything.
1929. After reaching an all-time high in June, the United States production index began to decline. The Roaring Twenties had seen an unprecedented growth in business. National income had advanced by 50% in just 7 years. But the new wealth was unevenly distributed. Gains in production were being made chiefly through mechanization, not through expansion of the labor force. The Twenties had not been good years for radical political movements. A post-World War I Red Scare and many internal disputes had weakened the left. New recruits were predominantly foreign-born and concentrated in big cities like New York. Anna Tafler.
I was born in Russia and I came here in 1914. It was the last ship out when the war was declared. I'm the youngest of four children. I had quite a comfortable home and a pretty good education. Even though my father was a rabbi's son, our home was a meeting ground of professional people, intellectuals, who always resented the oppression of the Tsar. Whenever a lecturer came to town, being we had a big house and being our house was available, it was always in our home. And some of it dropped off on me. But actually, when I came here, I was not quite 16, 15, 15 and a half years old. After meeting and getting acquainted with some young people who invited me to a lecture, and I was fortunate enough to hear Eugene Debs, and it was just in 1917, prior to the time that he was arrested. Yeah. And I was so inspired that when I was approached and asked to join, at that time was the YPSLs, the Young People's Socialist League. Uh-huh. I was approached and asked to join them. I asked what was the platform and they explained me. I gladly joined them and I became active.
Early in 1929, with the jobless figure over 400,000, the Communist Party and the Socialist Party had already begun to organize the unemployed. On Thursday, October 31st, the crisis arrived. With the collapse of the stock market, the boom came to a screeching halt.
The bridge down by the river, with arches overhead, it's home like there to me, that's where each night I make my bed. Underneath the arch.
Like many other people, Anna soon found herself in trouble over the rent. Her son had been in the hospital.
I had no home to bring him to because I got dispossessed for non-payment of rent, because the money for the rent went in to pay the hospital. That really started me off. I went to court to answer the dispossession. And walking to court, I really swept the streets with my tears, crying that there it is. I can bring my baby home, but I have no home to bring him to because I'm going to be put out. So I went to court to answer the dispossession. And the judge asked me, do you owe rent or don't you? I said, yes, Your Honor, but I will wish to explain. Pay the rent or get out. He didn't give me a chance to explain. So when I walked out of court, I said, the courts are not good, the system is not good, everything is not good. And I says, I'm going to fight like hell. And I started in.
Within 5 months, unemployment had increased 1,000% to over 4 million. While only a few ruined speculators leapt to their death from Wall Street windows, the number of evictions in poor neighborhoods skyrocketed. Whole families were threatened, and wives and mothers responded as they could.
And this is how I started in. I came and I had to bring the kid home, and I still had no home. So I started looking for help, asking around. And I had some friends, and they told me that organizing, there was such thing, they're organizing unemployment councils. It was first in the organizing stage. So I threw myself in into the organization of the unemployed councils.
Unemployment insurance did not exist. Relief derived almost entirely from charity. It was fragmented and inadequate. The Communist Party called demonstrations from coast to coast on March 6, 1930. 35,000 people attended the International Unemployment Day rally in New York City's Union Square. The event ended in a bloodbath, but the message was clear.
After this March 6th, 1930 demonstration, right. Although they were forced to recognize there's an unemployment situation, start establishing relief centers and giving relief, wherever possible, they tried to deny it. So every locality actually had to fight it out for itself.
My fellow citizens, this broadcast tonight
on March 7th, 1930, President Hoover told the nation that the worst effects of the crash on unemployment would be over in 60 days.
For those of our citizens and their families who, through no fault of their own, face unemployment and privation during...
Over the next 5 months, 4,000 people were arrested at radical demonstrations. Communist unemployed councils and the Socialist Workers Alliance brought pressure to bear directly on local relief bureaus. Funds for relief in 1929 had totaled $71 million nationally.
First, when we came into being, there were two unemployed organizations. The Unemployed Council was under the leadership of the Communist Party. The Workers' Alliance was under the leadership of the Socialist Party. So we would stay around the relief bureau, and we would talk to people. Mm-hmm. And people would tell us the troubles, and we would take down the complaints.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear.
By the following March, unemployment had doubled again. In New York, where protest was strong and Roosevelt governor, local relief improved during these early years of the Depression.
With peace and glory ahead.
Mary Gale worked in a New York relief bureau at the time.
Just waiting for bread.
I got a job in Long Island City in the home relief bureau as an investigator, and I was getting $28 a week. And they had just started the thing.
Once I built a railroad, now it's done.
We used to meet in a public school in a basement, and we sat on orange crates. They had nothing at all. And I got a caseload of about 44 workers in Long Island City. And the poorest, very poor people live in Long Island City on the waterfront. And I used to go to their homes and talk to them. And I used to give them money to go to meetings, my money. There's a meeting, you'll find out how to organize. Also, in Long Island City, they had to go to Astoria to get a sack of coal. Why do you have to do that? Why don't you go to a meeting and get organized so they can open a coal office here? They were poor, they were sick, they had no money. So after I would visit them in their homes, I'd say, now this is business out of the way. Now I'm going to talk to you as one person to another. Here's a dime or 15 cents for car fare. Go down to Astoria. There's a meeting tonight, and you'll learn how to get organized amongst yourselves so that the Home Relief Bureau could give you something more than you're getting. There was a woman in Queens who used to organize those people. I didn't know, but somebody introduced me to her. She had kind of come up to the Home Relief Bureau And she used to call for the investigator and give the investigator the devil, because the investigator didn't take care of all her clients. But after she'd get through, and when I get through my day's work, I'd go down to her home for dinner, and I gave her the names of all those people, and she would go down there and she'd organize them.
Buddy, can you spare a
dime? In 1932, the average grant to an unemployed person in New York City was $2.39 a week. Anna.
But their policy was to give as little relief as possible, only when they're rioting, only when there is a lot of commotion, only when you can't get away with it. But that was the policy. There was a constant struggle. It wasn't just a question of you come in there and you settle your grievances. It was a constant struggle. So we would come to the relief bureau at that time, and we would stay in the auditorium, and we would ask people, you know, we are from the unemployment council, we're from the Lakers Fund Workers Alliance, what are your needs, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And people would, they're only too glad, you know, to get help, you know. A quarter a month, you'd sign them up for membership. But they, if they didn't have the quarter, it was all right too, you know. But so we would represent them. Some people were denied rent and they were facing evictions. Some people were cut off of food. And you know how we did it? To open air meetings, put in a platform, right in the front of the relief bureau, and getting up and letting the people in the whole neighborhood know what's going on.
The national expenditure on relief grew by $100 million in 2 years and stood at $171 million in 1932. But such gains were extremely hard fought in the final months of the Hoover administration. Rose Kryzak.
We had some of the most dramatic demonstrations in those days before the Social Security was enacted. In 1932, I think, we marched from Union Square to City Hall, and I worked right across the street from City Hall. So when I marched down to City Hall, I went up to my room where I was the head of a department, and my windows overlooked. And it was a time when Bob Minor and Amter and Foster were beaten up. They were lying there. And my boss, who used to come to my room so he could see what's going on, she said, well, that they're getting what they deserve.
With unemployment heading for a peak between 12 and 15 million, membership in radical organizations was also on the rise. Anna Taffler found her way from the Young People's Socialist League into the Communist Party through her involvement with the unemployed councils.
And I was militant, and I was not afraid, and I was fighting police, you know. They wanted to recruit me. They approached me. And I had such a respect, without knowing the party, for what the people, how the people conducted themselves in the organization, such a respect. And I says, I can't join the Communist Party. This is why. I says, I can't always be at a meeting in time. I have two small children. And I was told that you have to be, if the meeting is 8 o'clock, you can't come in at 8:30. And they said, no, it's perfectly all right. They recruited me. They asked me to join.
Outside of the party, a number of community-based radical groups provided women specifically with a framework for protest. Molly Goldstein.
I joined women's activities in the community. Women's organizations. We had organized a United Council of Working Class Women, then we organized the Progressive Women's Councils, and I became very active in the community, connected with the different problems that the community faced, particularly the women, the housewives, who had to provide for the families and found prices too high.
Women were very effective in work within their traditional sphere. Turning closeness to family and community life into a strength, women often took the lead in the fight to protect tenants and homeowners, which became a key issue for the unemployed movement.
I was asked to go in and to organize an unemployment council in Ovington, the Italian section in Brooklyn. And over there, there were an awful lot of small homeowners. They were threatened with foreclosure. This was already after we fought and established the principle of getting relief But there was a whole section of small homeowners, because you owned a home, yeah, even though you were threatened with foreclosure, they wouldn't give you anything, any money for food. They wouldn't give you a voucher for food. Right. These people were desperate. So we started organizing by having open air meetings, and I was there practically along with one or two of the fellows standing by the platform. So you also had a bunch of reactionary, misled young kids that they were under the influence. I don't know if you heard them, if you knew anything about them, under the influence of Father Kagel. We had the, I remember this particular open air meeting, most of our open air meetings were held on 68th Street, corner 18th Avenue, mm-hmm, in Ovington. Mm-hmm. So these kids would shout and yell, "Why don't you go back where you come from? Why don't you go back to Russia?" Because of my accent, and we would still continue having our meetings. So then they went up on the roof and they started throwing things, tomatoes, eggs, whatever they could. But then they started throwing milk bottles. And this became a dangerous business. So I said to one of the guys, "Where is your police station? Let's go to the police station." So we went to the police station. We told them, "Look, we are an organization, a recognized organization." Mm-hmm. I said, "We're dealing with the relief authorities, we're recognized. We're having open air meetings. Mm-hmm. We want protection not just for ourselves, but you're responsible for your citizens right here, because they're throwing milk bottles, they're liable to kill somebody." So the captain at the police station says to me, "And how do you think the police are going to get up, fly up on the roof?" I says, "Look, Captain, you're not speaking to a child. I want one policeman stationed by the platform and one on the roof." And I says, "If you refuse to give it to me, then we'll go to the police commissioner." I says, "Okay." So they couldn't throw anymore from the roof, so they started shouting and yelling. You know, the policeman staying there. Yeah. So the policeman's pulling me by my dress. "Hey," he says, "Officer, are you talking to me?" He says, "Yes." I says, "Address me like a lady. What is it you want?" He says, "You can't speak here." I says, "Why not?" He says, "Because there's a riot here." Mm-hmm. I says, "That's what you're here for, officer." Mm-hmm. He says, "Why don't you go down to 13th Avenue? That's the Jewish district, you know. Blocks and blocks away, that's about 50, 60 blocks away." So I says, "Look, officer, when freedom of speech was written into the Constitution, they didn't designate certain areas that you can speak and certain that you can't speak. Right. And if you can't speak where we want to speak, then freedom of speech doesn't mean anything. And you, as an officer of the law, have to uphold the law." Mm-hmm. "What do you want me to do?" I says, "They don't have to stay here, this person." Yeah. And he did. Well, we organized these people from Orvington, and not only did we get them food, but we fought against the foreclosures of the homes, and we saved hundreds of homes.
Rose Kryzak organized tenants in Sunnyside, a small Queens neighborhood.
It wasn't really a rent strike. Mm-hmm. It was a mortgage moratorium. The homeowners organized themselves and declared a moratorium on mortgages. And that became the beginning of the national moratorium on mortgages. I was here as a tenant, but we supported the moratorium. In fact, when the first person they tried to evict from a home, we organized where we got three big men. They filled her sofa with rocks, and three men sat on them. And when the marshal came to put her out, we had a big mob outside, and they couldn't lift the sofa, and they never could evict her. That's the kind of activity that we were involved in. Then there were 97 houses, and they decided they would sell them out. And they were really asking very little for them. But half of the people couldn't afford even the little. And so we decided not to sell, urging people not to sell. A few people bought in spite of it, but the majority did not. I wasn't too involved in the buying and selling, but the owners decided or were told that I am probably the ringleader. And they decided that if they would get rid of me, they might have an easier time. So one day they called me and asked me if they can bring a buyer to see the house I lived in. And I quickly thought and told them they can come Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. At that time, I had no idea how we're going to react or what we're going to do. But by Saturday night, I reached a decision that I would call somebody on each block. There were 10 blocks. And ask them to bring some friends to visit me. Not to picket, not to have picket lines, not to make any noise. Just to come and quietly visit me. And by 11 o'clock that Sunday morning, there were several hundred people inside and out. And of course, the buyer never came in. And that became the method of fighting back.
In 1932, the breadth and strength of protest was felt at the ballot box.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have.
Federal relief programs began in earnest after the inauguration of Roosevelt in 1933.
It is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured.
By 1935, $2 billion would be allocated to local aid for the jobless, for food, and for housing. It would take continued militancy to see that the new programs were carried out.
The Communist Party was very helpful in helping us not to make rash decisions, because it was such a genteel community, and the people involved weren't communists or anywhere near, but they thought if we do anything too dramatic and too noisy, they might be turned off. And since we had a really united group, so they gave a lot of help, and we worked with them very closely.
Attempts to organize a national unemployed movement began as early as 1933. In 1935, the Comintern directed communists worldwide to form a popular front with socialist and liberal groups whom they had previously attacked. This cleared the way for a merger of the unemployed councils with the socialist-led Workers' Alliance. Anna Tafler.
At our planning meetings, we realized that having two separate organizations is not the best thing to help the unemployed. We figured that by uniting, although we didn't need a physical strength, we figured that by uniting and having one organization and having one leadership, a united leadership, we would best be able to serve the interests of the unemployed. So we approached the leadership of the Workers' Alliance. And negotiations went on for some time. They wanted everything. They wanted the presidency, they wanted their name, but we gave in on almost everything because we had so much confidence in our ability, in our honesty, in our militancy, to know that once we become one organization, the members will see for themselves, and that it's not going to be a question that you are the president, that you have carried the weight, that the members will support whatever is correct, whatever is right, because we did not always agree with that policy. Because our policy was a much more militant policy.
The party also tried to reach out to activist women's groups, which were becoming larger and more influential, especially in relief-related work. Lily Edel.
The 1936 election campaign was very, very significant, of course, for the election of FDR. And at that time, Alfred Landon was running on the Republican ticket, and there was the Liberty League that was supporting him, which of course is very similar to our conservative right today in the Republican Party. And our slogan was, even though we ran Earl Browder for president, our slogan was defeat Landon at all costs. And masses of people heard this. In those days we didn't have television, we had radio, and I made a public radio address as a representative of the Communist Party for the issues facing women in this campaign, for the rights of the women, for housing, for decent welfare, for medical care. And it turned out to be a very popular address because the state office had a lot of mail asking for copies of that speech outside of our party.
Within the left, however, few women reached leadership positions, even in the unemployed movement where they were very active. Rose Krizak.
I wasn't a leader in the party during that period. I never was a great leader, but I had leadership positions, but not top level, not policy making. I would sell the Daily World at the railroad station. I was a member of a club, industrial club, where I helped on a strike. For instance, when Phelps Dodge was on strike, we ran a kitchen that people in the community cooked, and our porch was the commissary. And things like that. I did a lot of that.
So great were the problems to be faced at the outset of the crisis that no one considered this to be a problem.
At that time, we didn't have a women's liberation movement. And at that time, our job was mostly support the men folks. They went on strikes. We helped with picketing. There were strikes. We set up kitchens. We set up food. A building needed cleaning, and they had a party, we did the cleaning, you know. We supported the men in their struggle. They didn't, we as women ourselves weren't, at that time, weren't recognized. We weren't pushed into leadership. I don't even remember us having our own platform.
Relief activity lost its local nature in 1935 as the New Deal drew the Workers' Alliance into lobbying activity on the federal and state level. With the focus taken off of local protest, the women's role became less important, and their inequality within the movement never became an issue. Rose Krizak.
See, I don't think I've felt anything about a woman in 1930. Yeah. I myself wasn't that aware of being a woman. Mm-hmm. I wasn't conscious of being different than a man.
The woman's role in the struggle probably did come up around the dinner table.
My husband's idea was that a woman's place is in the kitchen. Although he talked revolution very good, but he didn't practice what he talked. But anyhow, he's an honest person, but his understanding was limited.
The unemployed movement depended heavily on family women. Yet it is difficult to imagine how Anna Taffler found the time to raise a son while organizing families all over Brooklyn.
While I was dedicated to my work, I was dedicated to my family and my children. And although one of my comics took my younger son, and although she lived a block and a half from me and took him to her house, and school was right next door, and she took care of him, all the time I felt, you know, the responsibility weighing between home and children, and the responsibility I had to, you know, to go.
Molly Goldstein also had a son.
Sometimes friends who took care, and my mother, and sometimes I took him with me. When I spoke at open air meetings many times, he stood right near me. However, I do not regret my activities. But I would perhaps curtail a little bit to give a little bit more attention to my son than what I did in those days.
Rose Krizak.
I had around-the-clock help. Mm-hmm. But whatever I did, there are certain rules we had in our lives. That is, no matter where I had to go, I was always home for dinner. There was a family dinner. When the children even were babies, and as they grew up, we always had a dinner where we sat down and talked about things in the day, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I always put my children to bed, and then I'd go out.
Rose is still active. How do her grandchildren feel about sharing her with the struggles of today?
Oh, they know I'm a communist. They know that I'm active. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they often say, "What have you done today to raise hell about?" You know, they can't tease me, you know.
Recalling how fiercely these women fought in the 30s, we can hardly fear for their commitment in the face of such tender criticism. What gave them the strength? 2 months before her death at 82, Anna summed it up.
I'm active because I believe in socialism, and I'll work for a better, call it whatever you want, call it communism, call it socialism, call it anything. But what I want to see is a more humane, a more decent, a more equal society. That's what I want. I don't care what label you give it. I'm certainly not in the capitalist.
I saw the seamen standing proudly by the shore, and I heard the bosses saying, "Got no work for you no more."
But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door.
You have been listening to How Do You Spell Relief? Part 2 of Grandma Was an Activist, a radio series on radical women in the 1930s, produced for WBAI-FM and the Oral History of the American Left at New York University's Tamamat Institute Library. Oral historians for the series, John Bloom, B. Leamish, and Ruth Prego.
My brothers working throughout.
Project directors, Paul and Mary Jo Buell. Mix by Stephen Erickson. Our special thanks to the many interviewees and contributors who made this series possible.
banks of marble.
Grandma Was an Activist was produced by Beth Friend and Charles Potter, Radio Arts Incorporated. Your narrator is Jill Eikenberry. Grandma Was an Activist was made possible by a grant from the New York Council for the Humanities.